other thing that all fictional characters have in common is that each character, no matter whether they're simple or complex, no matter whether they're round or flat, no matter whether they're the leading character or a minor character, each character has a purpose in the narrative. Each one almost always has something he or she wants or something at stake. We'll talk more about this in the next lecture as we talk about developing a character through the course of a narrative. But it's something you need to be thinking about when you're introducing a character. Whether you're imagining your characters from the inside out or from the outside in, whether you're imagining them based on their psychology or their circumstances, all characters are constructed out of specific, vivid, visceral, sensuous, evocative details. And both the writer and the reader are never more aware of those specific details than they are in the moment when they meet a character. In other words, meeting a fictional character is a lot like meeting someone in real life. Think about the first moment you met someone important to you, a spouse or a friend or even an enemy. And the chances are very good that what you remember most vividly is something very specific about them, a physical feature or something they were wearing or some gesture they made or something specific they said or the particular circumstances in which you met them. We have a very similar experience with fictional characters. First impressions are very important. And we know within a page or two if we find a character appealing, interesting, or annoying. Think about the stories or books where you've fallen in love with a character on first sight, or even the books where you've given up after the first few pages because you realized quickly that you didn't want to spend any more time with this person. In real life, it's considered rude to turn your back on someone you've just been introduced to. But with a story or a book, you can shut it and walk away and no one's feelings are hurt. To help you think about making that all-important first impression, let's take a look at five different ways we can be introduced to a new character. One, through a straightforward description of the character. Two, by seeing the character in action. Three, through direct address in the first person from the character. Four, through report by other characters. Five, by placing the character in a specific time and place. As I go through the various examples of each technique, I especially want you to notice how each technique uses details and specifics, and how the introduction to the character reveals or at least hints at what the character wants. Perhaps the most straightforward way to introduce a character is simply to describe him or her. Here's the very first paragraph of one of my favorite novels, Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim. He was an inch, perhaps two, under 6 feet, powerfully built, and he advanced straight at you with a slight stoop of the shoulders, head forward, and a fixed-from-under stare which made you think of a charging bull. His voice was deep, loud, and his manner displayed a kind of dogged self-assertion which had nothing aggressive in it. It seemed a necessity, and it was directed apparently as much at himself as at anybody else. He was spotlessly neat, apparelled in immaculate white from shoes to hat, and in the various eastern ports where he got his living as a ship chandler's water clerk, he was very popular. Now here's your main character coming right off the page at the reader, and we see him vividly and whole from his fixed-from-under stare to his immaculate white shoes. The introduction is compelling and intriguing, which is what the opening of a novel should be. Here's a rather attractive character who also has a bit of mystery about him. Think about that dogged self-assertion that is directed apparently as much at himself as anybody else. Without giving anything away, that's the main character of Lord Jim in a nutshell. He's a man who has something to prove to himself, and the rest of the book shows why that's the case and how he goes about it. The introduction is also economical. It's not the sort of description that lingers over every detail of a character's appearance and his clothing, but merely suggests physical attributes that evoke awkwardness, the slight stoop of the shoulders, the deep, loud voice, and adds a few conjectures about his character, that his manner was assertive but not aggressive, and allows the reader to fill in the rest. This is not to say that giving an elaborate description of the character is necessarily a bad thing. Lots of books and stories introduce the physical appearance of a character in great detail. As always, it depends on the book and on what you're trying to do. At any rate, the point is that Jim is shown to us, not told. He is evoked. We know that he is muscular, that he is fastidious about his appearance, that he has a direct, blunt, but not intimidating manner, and that he is concerned with proving something to himself. After little more than 100 words, we have a very intriguing, though not comprehensive, view of the main character. I also want you to notice that although this description is very detailed and specific, it's not tied to a specific moment in Jim's life. We're not getting a scene, per se. And I also want you to notice that this is an example of a character being introduced to us from the outside in. We're seeing how he appears to other people, not how he seems to himself. And just to reiterate what I said in the last lecture, defining a character from the outside in is not the same as defining him by his circumstances, just as defining a character from the inside out is not the same as defining him by his psychology. Although we hear Jim speaking later in the book, we're never really inside his head, and yet Lord Jim is fundamentally a psychological portrait of an idealistic young man trying to live down a moment of cowardice. Now let's take a look at a character who is introduced to the reader in a specific moment through a specific action. It comes from another favorite novel of mine, a very slim book called Light by the English writer Eva Figgis. Here's the opening of the book. The sky was still dark when he opened his eyes and saw it through the uncurtained window. He was upright within seconds, out of the bed, and had opened the window to study the signs. It looked good to him, the dark just beginning to fade slightly, midnight blue-black, growing gray and misty, through which he could make out the last light of a dying star. It looked good to him, a calm pre-dawn hush without a breath of wind and not a shadow of cloud in the high, clear sky. He took a deep breath of air, heavy with night scents and dew on earth and foliage. His appetite for the day thoroughly aroused, his elated mood turned to energy, and he was into his dressing room, into the cold bath, which set his skin tingling, humming an unknown tune under his breath. This is also a very intriguing opening, though in a different way. It's dynamic in a way that the opening of Lord Jim is not. The character is in action, with all his senses awake, right from the first sentence. And he looks at the view outside his window with a gaze that is both practiced and eager. Moments later, he's in a cold bath, his senses tingling. And unlike the opening of Lord Jim, where we can only surmise what Jim is thinking from his appearance, Figgis gives us direct access to the character's thoughts. Although we don't know it yet, this is the French artist Claude Monet, and he's just decided that this will be a very good day to paint. But even before we realize who the man is, we get a vivid and attractive first impression of a man who pays keen attention to the natural world and is eager to engage with it, though we don't know why or how till a few pages further on. And yet, unlike the opening of Lord Jim, it tells us nothing of his physical appearance and not much more about his psychology than the simple fact that he's enthusiastic about starting his day. But whereas in Lord Jim it's the hint of complexity in the character that keeps us reading, in this case it's the character's energy and our curiosity to discover why he's so engaged with the natural world. So even though we don't learn as much about Monet in this opening paragraph as we do about Jim in his opening paragraph, the opening of Light is just as compelling. There's another tried and true way of introducing a character, one that seems somehow uniquely American, though I'm sure there are plenty of similar examples in the literature of other countries. This is by having the main character, or at least the first-person narrator, directly address the reader. Three of the novels that are often cited as the great American novel open this way. Moby Dick begins with its narrator inviting the reader to call me Ishmael. The Great Gatsby opens with Nick Carraway, who isn't the main character, but who is the predominant voice in the book, speaking directly to the reader. And, of course, there's the opening of Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter. Over the years, there have been any number of great American novels whose narrators address the reader on the opening page. Saul Bellow's The Adventures of Augie March, the title of which deliberately echoes Twain, opens with a declamatory sentence that evokes Melville. I am an American, Chicago-born, Chicago that somber city, and go at things as I have taught myself, freestyle, and will make the record in my own way. First to knock, first admitted, sometimes an innocent knock, sometimes not so innocent. The narrator of Marilyn Robinson's novel Housekeeping also echoes Melville by announcing in the first sentence, my name is Ruth, and then echoes Twain by immediately summarizing the story so far, the way Huck Finn does in the first few paragraphs of his novel. Here's a more recent example by the novelist Kate Christensen from her book The Epicure's Lament. October 9, 2001. All the lonely people indeed. Whoever they are, I've never been one of them. The lack of other people is a balm. It's the absence of strain and stress. I understand monks and hermits, anyone who takes a vow of silence or lives in a far-flung cave. And I thought, I hoped rather, that I would live this way for the rest of my life, whatever time is left to me. In the subsequent paragraphs, this narrator, Hugo Whittier, gives us some specific details of his mourning, as well as some hints of his backstory. But mainly what this opening gives us, and what it has in common with all those other first-person openings I just listed, is that it draws the reader in with a very specific and intriguing voice. In this example, we can see right away that the character is literate and erudite, that he not only prefers his own company, but that he harbors an active hostility to other people, and that he's something of a fatalist who doesn't expect to live much longer. In all these examples, the paragraphs immediately following the opening line or paragraph start to fill in the details about the character's history and current situation. But what draws us in is the fact that we're hearing an individual person telling us his or her story in a way that only he or she could tell it to us. So even if we don't know what they look like right off the bat or see them in action right away, and most of the books I've just mentioned, we don't get action for a few pages yet, we know we're hearing from a unique and specific individual. Another way to introduce the character is by report. Now, obviously, if you want to be nitpicking about it, all fictional characters are introduced to us by report through the intermediary of the writer. But, as I say, in fiction we often have the illusion of direct access. But some characters are presented to us only through the eyes of other characters. Jim in Lord Jim is one such character, since we never get inside his head and mainly learn his story through other characters. Another example is Jay Gatsby, whose story is told to us by the first-person narrator, Nick Carraway. The example I want to quote from, though, is William Faulkner's famous story, A Rose for Emily. Here's the first paragraph. When Miss Emily Grierson died, our whole town went to her funeral. The men through a sort of respectful affection for a fallen monument, the women mostly out of curiosity to see the inside of her house, which no one save an old manservant, a combined gardener and cook, had seen in at least 10 years. Right away, you notice that it's an unnamed first-person narrator speaking on behalf of his or her entire town. Then, after 4 paragraphs that describe Miss Emily's house, her family history, and her standoffish relationship with the town, we get a very detailed physical description as part of a brief flashback describing the day that the town's alderman paid a visit to her, hoping to persuade her to pay her taxes. They rose when she entered, a small, fat woman in black with a thin gold chain descending to her waist and vanishing into her belt, leaning on an ebony cane with a tarnished gold head. Her skeleton was small and spare. Perhaps that was why what would have been merely plumpness in another was obesity in her. She looked bloated, like a body long submerged in motionless water and of that pallid hue. Her eyes, lost in the fatty ridges of her face, looked like 2 small pieces of coal pressed into a lump of dough as they moved from one face to another while the visitors stated their errand. This is perhaps the most vivid of the introductions I've cited so far. And mainly what I want you to notice about it is that we're not seeing Miss Emily from a remote third-person point of view, as in the opening of Lord Jim or the opening of Light. And we're not hearing from her directly in her own voice, as in the Epicure's Lament. But rather, we're hearing about her from the communal point of view of an entire community. And that's important, especially in this story. A character is being revealed to us as an object of fascination to an entire town. And because Emily has withdrawn herself from the life of the community, the people of the town have spun all sorts of legends and theories around her, all of which have the rug yanked out from under them at the end of the story, which is one of the creepiest endings in American literature. As always, I want you to notice the very vivid, even pungent details Faulkner deploys to describe Miss Emily, especially that wonderfully disturbing comparison of her elderly, fat body to that of a bloated corpse submerged in water, and not just any water, but motionless water. Again, without giving the ending away, this single paragraph foreshadows a great deal about the character and her story, without being explicit, and, at the same time, it provides the reader with an extremely vivid, one might almost say repulsive, visual impression of her. The four ways I've suggested so far of introducing a character certainly aren't exhaustive, and I also want to make it clear that very, very rarely does any introduction of a character rely solely on one technique. The last example, from A Rose for Emily, combines several techniques at once: introduction by report, introduction by physical description, and in the paragraphs immediately following the paragraph I quoted, introduction by showing the character in action, speaking dismissively to the men who've come to see her. Let's take a look at one more way of introducing character, namely the technique of introducing a character by situating him or her in a very specific time or place. This is the opening paragraph of Robert Stone's A Flag for Sunrise. Father Egan left off writing, rose from his chair, and made his way, a little unsteadily, to the bottle of Flor de Canna, which he had placed across the room from his desk. The study in which he worked was lit by a Coleman lamp. He had turned the mission generators off to save kerosene. The shutters were open to receive the sea breeze, and the room was cool and pleasant. At Freddy's chicken shack up the road, a wedding party was in progress, and the revelers were singing along with the radio from Puerto Alvarado, marking the reggae beat with their own steel drums and crockery. Again, as in A Rose for Emily, this is a very pungent introduction to a character, but one which relies almost entirely on his circumstances and a little bit of action, rather than a description or direct access to his thoughts. We get no physical description of Father Egan, but we know from the very first sentence that he's a bit of a scholar because he's been writing, and we also know that he's been drinking because he's unsteady on his feet, and that he's self-conscious about his drinking because he has deliberately placed the bottle across the room from his desk so that he has to get up each time he wants another drink. The rest of the paragraph says nothing about him specifically, but with great economy and expertly deployed detail shows us that he's living at a mission in a third world country where money is scarce, that it's near the sea, and that the local residents are probably impoverished, celebrating a wedding noisily at a place called Freddy's Chicken Shack. The rest of the chapter tells us a great deal more about Father Egan's situation and history, and about the perilous political situation in a fictional Latin American country during the 1970s, but that opening paragraph gives us a very vivid and compelling portrait of a lonely, drunken priest cut off from any intellectual stimulation, far from home, simultaneously using the setting to show us the character and the character's point of view to show us the setting. Let's pause for a moment here and sum up the lessons of the previous examples, specifically what they all have in common. Each one is constructed of specific, evocative details of Jim's physical appearance in Lord Jim, of Claude Monet's energetic actions in Light, of Hugo's comic bitterness in The Epicure's Lament, of Emily's appearance and imperious manner in A Rose for Emily, and of Father Egan's physical setting in A Flag for Sunrise. More importantly, each introduction tells us at least one thing about the character that turns out to be important later on, and at least hints at what the character has at stake. Right from the start, we know that Jim has something to prove to himself, that Claude Monet is passionately engaged with the natural world, that Hugo loathes the company of other people, that Emily has withdrawn from the world for some reason, and that Father Egan has isolated himself in a remote village in a distant country. So given that what each of these characters wants or has at stake is at least hinted at from our very first meeting with them, how much does the writer have to know about the character before he or she even starts writing? Well, for one thing, as I mentioned in my first lecture, you don't need to write a story or a novel in the same order as the reader is going to read it. You can craft the meatier parts of the character's story first, and then go back and write the opening in such a way as to foreshadow what you've already written. Another method is to work out all of the character's physical details, history, and context in advance. You might call this the iceberg theory of character creation. On the principle that most of an iceberg is out of sight below the waterline, keeping the visible part afloat, some writers concoct whole backstories for their characters, even if they don't use all or even most of it in the finished story. Some writers even create a dossier or a journal for each major character in a story, crafting a detailed history of each character and compiling every quirk and idiosyncrasy before they ever put them in a story. The novelist and teacher Janet Burroway compares this technique to the famous method used by actors, one of the features of which is that actors are required to write biographies of their characters, coming up with details that even the playwriter or screenwriter hadn't thought of. This method has a lot to recommend it, since it means even before you start to worry about plot, you have a fully formed character fixed firmly in your head, making it easier to decide what he or she is likely to do at any given moment as the plot develops. As I said in the opening lecture of this course, there is no right or wrong way to do things in fiction writing, so if this works for you, have at it. That said, my own experience of creating characters is a more indirect, exploratory, and improvisatory process, and I suspect that's the case with many other writers. Writers who work this way start with only a little bit of information about a character, the way a person looks, perhaps, or even a simple character trait like a nervous tic, or even just the way they wear a hat. We don't start with a full portrait of a character, but with a glimpse just intriguing enough to make us want to follow that character through scene after scene, to see how the character develops, or simply to see what he does next. The iceberg method is perhaps like that of a classical composer, who composes detailed sketches of themes and movements before embarking on the entire symphony, while my method is perhaps more like jazz, where a musician takes a scrap of melody and sees what he can spin out of it for 20 minutes at a stretch. Please bear in mind that I'm not necessarily endorsing my way of doing things, which is kind of a weird thing to say, actually, but let me explain how it has worked for me in the past and why I still create characters that way, on the fly, as it were. When I was writing my first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, one of my main characters was a terrorist, a member of the Irish Republican Army named Jimmy Coogan. All I knew about him to begin with was that he was disgruntled with the leadership of the IRA, and he wanted to embarrass them by setting off an unauthorized bomb in central London. But that's all I had, a Northern Irish Catholic in his late 20s or early 30s who hated the British, but who hated certain members of his own organization even more. I didn't know what he looked like, I didn't know what he sounded like, I didn't know how he thought. I could have invented a complicated backstory for him or filled a notebook with a dossier detailing everything I could think of about him, but instead, I simply started writing the novel, putting him in a car with 10 pounds of plastic explosive on his way to a meeting with a Confederate. It was only as I wrote that I started accumulating details. He wasn't just driving a car, he was driving a rented Ford Escort that smelled of cigarette smoke. And he wasn't just carrying the explosives, he was carrying them in a leather Adidas sports bag. And he wasn't just going anywhere for the meeting but to Giant's Causeway, a tourist destination on the northern coast of Ulster, away from the prying eyes of British soldiers and policemen. As I accumulated these details, I began to sense not only his wariness, but also his self-consciousness about being wary, which made him uncomfortable. I also took care of some exposition by having him mull over why he was breaking ranks with the leadership of the IRA. But even then, he didn't really come alive to me until I gave him a particular item of clothing, namely a brand new raincoat, the kind with big lapels and a belted waist. It was the sort of coat, in fact, that an IRA man of the late 1970s or early 1980s would never have been caught dead in. Real Irish terrorists of the era were a pretty scruffy lot, working-class guys from very rough neighborhoods in Belfast. So when I had my scruffy working-class character steal an expensive Burberry raincoat from a posh men's store in London, he suddenly snapped into focus and became an individual, a living person. The theft not only symbolized his break with the puritanism and caution of the IRA leadership, who certainly didn't want their operatives drawing attention to themselves with flashy trench coats, but more importantly, it symbolized Jimmy's own self-mythologizing romanticism and vanity. Here was a character who not only had decided to break with the discipline and orthodoxy of a radical movement, he wanted to look good while he was doing it. So by giving him this incongruous coat, I began to learn what Jimmy Coogan looked like, what he sounded like, how he carried himself when he walked down the street. It's entirely possible I would have arrived at the same point if I had used the iceberg method and painstakingly constructed a dossier for Jimmy in advance. It's possible I might even have come up with the raincoat, but I kind of doubt it. I had to launch myself sink or swim into the story by putting a guy I barely knew into a complicated situation and, by the steady accumulation of detail, the Ford Escort, the Adidas bag, Giant's Causeway, stumbling onto the one detail that gave me the key to his character, that showed me that not only was he a true believer who refused to compromise his revolutionary ideology, but also that he was vain, cocky, and rash. By writing my way into Jimmy Coogan, I was also telling myself the story, learning about Jimmy bit by bit, the same way the reader eventually would. But here is where the iceberg method and mine come together. By the time I finished the book, I knew Jimmy Coogan intimately, and you could have asked me anything about him. What did he like to drink? What was his favorite movie? What was his mother like? And I could have told you, perhaps not instantly, but after a moment or two of reflection. If you'd asked me what he was like before I started writing, I couldn't have told you much about him at all. It was only by the actual process of writing him that he became clear to me, so that even though I could hardly answer any questions about him when I started, by the time I finished the book, I could have told you things about him I'd never consciously considered. Even if I didn't use the iceberg method, I ended up with an iceberg. In other words, creating character is usually and most productively a process of exploration. By discovering a character as you go, you are learning about the character the same way that the reader will, a bit at a time. And when you think about it, the iceberg method works pretty much on the same principle. It's just that you do all the hard graft of imagining the character independently of creating the plot. You're still working by trial and error, trying out bits in your character journal and rejecting them, making the character clearer and clearer with each step. I'm just saying that for me, the process works better if I'm telling the story at the same time, because the story reveals the character, even as the character determines the story. I'm not saying my way is easier or even more efficient. In fact, it's probably less efficient. You will wander into blind alleys and dead ends, and you may find yourself tearing up whole chapters and starting them over, the way I have many times. But you might also say that those blind alleys and dead ends are signs that the process is working. If you write a scene that feels flat or seems like something the character wouldn't do, that means that the character has started to live an independent existence in your imagination, digging in his heels or standing up on her hind legs and saying, "I won't do that. That's not me." And that's a very good sign, because then your character is beginning to behave like a real person with a will and an inner life of his own, and he or she will come alive on the page. So whichever method you prefer, creating the character independently of the story or making him up as you go along, the point is that while you don't have to know a character completely when you start, if things go the way they're supposed to, you'll know him by the end as well as you know yourself, and maybe even better. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you think about introducing a character. Take someone you know a lot about, either in your personal life or someone famous, and write a paragraph about them as if you were introducing them for the first time as a fictional character. Bear in mind as you write it that your imaginary reader is meeting these people for the first time, so you're going to have to think hard about what sort of first impression they make, how they look, how they act, how they speak. If you're writing about someone famous, write it as if that person isn't famous and we're meeting her for the first time. If you're writing about someone you know personally, write it as if they're never going to read it, and then for heaven's sake, don't show it to them. This is meant to be a writing exercise, one that focuses your attention on distilling a whole person into a few hundred words. In the next lecture, we'll be talking about how to use different types of characters, round and flat characters, major and minor characters, in the same narrative. And we'll be looking at examples from the work of Twain, Dickens, Fitzgerald, and the Scottish mystery writer Denise Mina.
Lecture 6. Characters. Round and flat, major and minor.
Not all characters are created equal. In fact, some characters are decidedly more equal than others. There are major characters and minor characters with all sorts of varieties in between. There are narratives that have only one character or only one dominant character. There are also narratives that have ensembles in which no one character takes the lead. George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire has so many characters that the author needs to provide a list of them at the back of each volume. The list at the back of A Clash of Kings, the second volume in the series, goes on for 30 pages. As I've said several times already, different sorts of stories require different sorts of characters. Elizabeth Bennet in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice is one of the most vividly evoked and beloved characters in literature. She's smart, sharp-tongued, judgmental, and fiercely loyal to her sisters, even when they don't deserve it. But we never get a description of what she looks like, and we don't need to, because what's important about Elizabeth Bennet is her quicksilver wit and her place in the social order. On the other hand, Dashiell Hammett gives us a very specific physical description of Sam Spade on the very first page of The Maltese Falcon. Hammett shows us the detective's gestures and physical movements in great detail, because Spade is a man of action caught in a fluid and fast-moving situation, and it's important for us to see exactly how he moves through his world. Elizabeth Bennet and Sam Spade are two very different characters from two very different worlds in two very different books, so it makes sense that they would be constructed very differently. But you can also have different types of characters in the same story because they fulfill different functions. Take your typical episode of Star Trek as an example. There are the leading players, Kirk and Spock. There are the secondary characters, Scotty and Uhura. And then there are the minor characters, the famous red shirts, each of whom says a line or two if he's lucky, and then gets killed before the opening credits. A red shirt's chief function is to lie face down in the dirt so that Dr. McCoy can kneel over him and say, "He's dead, Jim." Your leading characters are the main focus of the story, so you want to know as much detail about them as possible. But minor characters such as red shirts, or what they call in the theater the spear carriers, exist only to deliver a line or a plot point. In Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, the main reason you keep reading is to find out if Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler are ever going to get together, and then when they do, if they are going to stay together. You don't read to find out what happens to the Tarleton brothers, the two boys who were wooing Scarlett in the opening pages. In a big, expansive novel like Gone with the Wind, with lots of characters who pop on, do their bit, and disappear again forever, the minor characters only need to be useful and efficient and not much more. You're not going to lavish as much attention on a minor character as you do on your major characters. There are also narratives, such as A Song of Ice and Fire, where no one character dominates, and the world being evoked is the main reason for reading the story. In a narrative like this, you may not have the luxury of long descriptions of each character or subtle evocations of their psychology. Even the major characters in this sort of narrative need to be sketched in quick, vivid strokes because there are so many of them and there is so much story to tell. But it's important to remember that even the minor characters in a novel or a story, even the characters who exist to deliver a single line or just keel over dead, still have something at stake. Part of what I mean is that all characters fulfill a purpose in the narrative, even if it's only to do one thing and then disappear. But I also mean that even characters who only appear once and do one thing have at least the potential to be major characters in a different version of the same story. In a well-imagined, vividly evoked fictional world, you want to create even your minor characters with enough attention to detail and with enough respect for their potential inner life that they could step up and act like major characters if required. Remember what I said in my very first lecture. A plot is only one particular way of looking at a story. The same set of circumstances could be told in countless different ways from the point of view of any one of the characters in it. All characters potentially have an inner life as rich as that of your main characters, and in that sense, all characters are created equal. This potentiality adds to the richness of the fictional world, giving the reader the feeling that the world the writer is evoking is larger and more comprehensive than the story he's chosen to tell. In an imaginary world that has this potential, the reader has the feeling that she could take a left turn away from the main story and just keep going. In fact, over the whole past half century, a whole subgenre of revisionist literature has grown up in which famous stories are told from a different character's point of view. John Gardner's Grendel, for example, tells Beowulf from the monster's point of view. In The Wind Done Gone, Alice Randall retells the story of Gone with the Wind from the point of view of a slave. And Valerie Martin's novel, Mary Riley, retells the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the point of view of one of Dr. Jekyll's servants. That said, in most narratives, you can't treat all the characters equally. It would read like a transcript of a surveillance tape. Even important characters can be divided into types, not only between different kinds of books, as between Pride and Prejudice and The Maltese Falcon, but sometimes even between characters in the same story. One of these differences is the distinction between round characters and flat characters. This distinction is one of the most famous tropes in the teaching of creative writing, and it was formulated by the English novelist E.M. Forster in his book, Aspects of the Novel. The terms have become so famous that you probably have already heard of round and flat characters, even if you've never read Forster's book or even heard of E.M. Forster. Let's take a moment to review what he actually said. Flat characters, according to Forster, have sometimes been called humorous types or caricatures. Their chief distinguishing feature is that they have, well, one chief distinguishing feature. As Forster puts it, in their purest form, they are constructed round a single idea or quality. When there is more than one factor in them, we get the beginning of the curve towards the round. The really flat character can be expressed in one sentence. And here, Forster gives some examples which may not be readily recognizable to a 21st century reader, so I'll provide some examples of my own. In The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Huck himself is round, but he is surrounded by characters of varying degrees of flatness. A good example of a flat character is Huck's rotten father, Pap Finn, who can be summed up, as Forster suggests, in a single sentence. To wit, Huck's father is a mean drunk. That's all you really need to know about him, that he drinks, that he's basically good for nothing, and that he treats Huck very badly. Like the poor, neglected Tarleton brothers in Gone with the Wind, Pap exists mainly to further the plot. When Huck can't stand Pap's abuse anymore, he fakes his own death and takes off down the Mississippi River with the slave Jim. After that, Pap's only other function in the story is to turn up dead later on, thus freeing Huck from any family obligations. Now, the works of Charles Dickens are famously full of flat characters. You have Uriah Heep and David Copperfield, who is conniving and oily. You have Bill Sykes and Oliver Twist, who is a brutal criminal. You have Miss Havisham in Great Expectations, who was abandoned at the altar on her wedding day as a young woman and has set herself apart from the rest of the world ever since. You might even think of such characters as the sort of people you'd find in a sitcom. The clueless dad, the wacky neighbor, the gay best friend, the wisecracking child. Sitcom characters of this sort are often just machines for delivering or setting up jokes, and the moment they appear on screen, you know exactly what to expect. Indeed, it's that quick identification and the sudden anticipation of something funny, if not necessarily surprising, that often makes such characters so popular. They may be simple, they may be predictable, but they are also reliably satisfying. It's the same with flat characters in fiction. One of the great advantages of flat characters, says Forster, is that they are easily recognized whenever they come in, recognized by the reader's emotional eye, not by the visual eye, which merely notes the recurrence of a proper name. That part, the ease of recognition, is crucial. The most important trait of a flat character is the fact that the minute he or she reappears, you get the whole effect of them right away. Whenever Bill Sykes turns up on Oliver Twist, we immediately know something bad is going to happen. He does the same sort of thing, or threatens to, every time he appears. So although Bill may be a very bad man from the point of view of the other characters in Oliver Twist, he is, from the point of view of the writer and the reader, very reliable and satisfyingly frightening. The fact that he produces the same effect every time does not really diminish the satisfaction of the effect. This, in fact, is what Forster calls the flat character's second advantage, that they are easily remembered by the readers afterwards. Says Forster, "It is a convenience for an author when he can strike with his full force at once, and flat characters are very useful to him, since they never need reintroducing, never run away, have not to be watched for development, and provide their own atmosphere." It's also important to note that a flat character needs to be both simple and vivid. If a character is just simple but not memorable, then the character doesn't really serve its purpose. And if he's vivid but not simple, then he's not a flat character. Now, please bear in mind that a flat character is not the same thing as a minor character. For one thing, a minor character can be round. Take George Wilson, for example, who was the working-class garage owner in F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. He only appears in a few scenes, but late in the story, his grief after a tragic accident is one of the most moving scenes in the novel. Someone who was just a caricature up to that point, the clueless, cuckolded husband, becomes for a page or two a real human being. For another thing, a flat character could be very important to a story. Miss Havisham is one of the most memorable and influential characters in Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. She never develops or changes, and she is essentially the same character in her final scene as she was in her first. But if you took her out of the book, you'd lose one of the major plot lines of the novel. In fact, it's possible to have a story or a novel that is peopled entirely with flat characters. Forster himself claims that all the characters in Dickens are flat, even the leading ones like Pip in Great Expectations or the title character in David Copperfield. And consider Sherlock Holmes. Not only is he the major character in Conan Doyle's stories, he's the main reason we read them at all. And while very occasionally Holmes makes the curve towards the round, as Forster puts it, he is usually triumphantly flat. He produces the same effect in nearly every scene, in every story, every single time he appears. Indeed, most readers would be pretty badly disappointed if Holmes suddenly burst into tears or fell in love or exhibited a passion for anything other than the art of deduction. He is clearly flat by Forster's definition, because he never really develops and because you almost always get the full effect of him every time he appears. He's also proof that flat characters are not necessarily simple or sketchy, and that they can be very detailed. Indeed, Sherlock Holmes is one of the most detailed characters in popular fiction, from Conan Doyle's very specific description of his physical appearance, to his distinctive mannerisms, to the elaborately evoked rooms he shares with Dr. Watson on Baker Street. Let's look now at round characters. Forster himself does not offer a formal definition of roundness the way he does for flatness, but he shows us what a round character is by giving us examples. The closest that he comes to defining a round character is when he says that the test of a round character is whether it is capable of surprising in a convincing way. If it never surprises, it is flat. If it does not convince, it is a flat pretending to be round. The very nature of round characters is encapsulated in the metaphor we use to describe them. Round characters curve up and away from the flat page into three dimensions. They have different sides and aspects, unlike flat characters, who appear the same from every angle. Round characters are also richer, deeper, and more mysterious and unpredictable than flat characters. They can do all the things a flat character can do. They can come vividly to life. They can be memorable and instantly recognizable. They can be just as engaging and delightful and entertaining. But they can also surprise us, delight us, and disappoint us the way real people can and flat characters cannot. As Forster puts it, round characters don't just surprise us. They surprise us in a convincing way. This part is important. Flat characters can be surprising, too, but flat characters provide only the sort of mechanical surprise you get from a mystery or a spy novel when a trustworthy character suddenly turns out to be the murderer or the double agent. While this kind of surprise can be effective, it can also come across as cheating, as if the writer hasn't been playing by the rules. Our response to this kind of surprise is often a groan or a roll of the eyes. On the other hand, the kind of surprise we get from a round character should evoke not just shock, but at the same moment, the strong feeling of inevitability. You should be thinking, of course, I should have seen that coming. When a round character surprises us, we're delighted or moved in ways that flat characters can't manage, by actions that we didn't expect, but which we believe the moment we see them. Round characters can also break our hearts in ways that flat characters can't. They can disappoint us in a lifelike way, the way loved ones or friends can sometimes disappoint us. The actions of round characters should be both surprising and inevitable. Whatever happens to a round character is probably the only way things could have turned out for them, not because of her circumstances necessarily, but because of her own flawed, complex nature that drove her to it. Take the most famous adulterous wife in 19th century literature, Anna Karenina, from Leo Tolstoy's novel. You don't have to be clairvoyant to guess early on that Anna's story is not going to end well. And yet, her ending breaks your heart, because you have become so intimately acquainted with every aspect of Anna through Tolstoy's ceaselessly detailed evocation of her character. In my first lecture on character, I pointed out that fictional people are different from real people because we can know what they're thinking, which is perhaps another definition of roundness. This is true even if the writer never actually shows us what the character is thinking, as long as the potential is there for the writer to show the character's thoughts. By the same token, a character may be considered round as long as he or she has the potential to change, even if they never actually do. Some of the most heartbreaking people in fiction are rounded characters who, for whatever reason, lose their nerve or are defeated by circumstance. One of my favorite short stories is Anton Chekhov's The Kiss. In this story, a dull little man is offered a chance for passion early in the story, does not take it, and then spends the rest of the story thinking uselessly about that lost opportunity. He's the same person at the end of the story as he is at the beginning. But by the end, even though nothing changes, we as readers have a deeper understanding of what he's lost and just how tragic that loss is, even if the character himself doesn't see it. I also want to stress, as I did in the previous lecture, that the complexity or roundness of a character isn't necessarily defined entirely by psychology. It can be defined by their circumstances as well. Both kinds of characters can aspire to roundness. Our old friend Mrs. Dalloway is round because we are inside her head at every moment, listening to her private thoughts. On the other hand, consider Paddy Meehan, a young Scottish journalist who is the main character of a series of gritty detective novels by the Scottish writer Denise Mina. We see these stories from Paddy's point of view, and we are given direct access to her thoughts. But much of the richness of her character comes from her circumstances, from Mina's skillful evocation, through Paddy's eyes, of the dank, melancholy world of working-class Glasgow in the 1970s and 80s. Certainly, Paddy is a psychologically rich character, but her psychology has been formed largely by her reaction to the world in which she lives. She's been shaped specifically by her oppressive Catholic family, her drippy boyfriend, and the overtly macho atmosphere of the newspaper where she works, not to mention by her social class and the times in which she lives, both of which Mina evokes in great detail. So, to oversimplify a bit, we can say that flatness and roundness in fictional characters each depend on holding two potentially contradictory values in balance. Flat characters should be both simple and vivid, and round characters should be both surprising and convincing. A flat character is instantly recognizable, and we view him from a slight remove. The author tends not to invite us to see the world from a flat character's point of view. On the other hand, a round character takes more time to get to know, and often, though not always, we are invited to see the world through her eyes. Please note that I am not saying that all characters need to be likable. Most writers and readers don't have a problem with flat, unlikable characters because we don't have as much invested in flat characters. But somehow, the expectation has grown up among some readers and writers that round characters, or at least main characters, should be likable. This is a pet peeve of mine. As a novelist whose principal characters are universally unlikable, or so I'm told, I take particular exception to the belief that a character needs to be likable in order to be worth reading about. I'm not saying that great characters have to be unlikable. Certainly Huck Finn and Jay Gatsby and Dr. Watson, not to mention countless people in Dickens, are very attractive people. But think of all the great characters throughout the history of literature who are not only unlikable, but downright unpleasant. Achilles in the Iliad is vain and arrogant and vengeful. Captain Ahab in Moby Dick is a heartless obsessive. Mrs. Dalloway is a shocking snob. Lady Macbeth is murderously ambitious. Humbert Humbert in Lolita is a manipulative pedophile, and so on. These are all great characters, but in real life, we'd probably want to have nothing to do with any of them. One of the great things about literature is that we're able to broaden our experience of human nature through reading, with no real risk to our safety or our morals. Reading about Lady Macbeth is a bracing experience, but hearing her story doesn't necessarily make us want to murder our spouse's boss. This brings me to perhaps the most important distinction between flat and round characters, or at least important as it seems to me, since Forster himself doesn't mention it. This has to do with the idea of conflict in fiction, which we will discuss again when we talk about plotting. But for now, I want to make a generalization which may not always apply, but applies often enough that I think it's useful. All characters want something or are driven by something. Or, as I put it a few minutes ago, all characters have something at stake in the narrative. Flat characters only want one simple thing. Sherlock Holmes only wants to solve a mystery, to the point of driving every other consideration out of his head. Miss Havisham only wants revenge against men. Round characters, on the other hand, want something complicated or ineffable or ambiguous. Another way to put it is to say that they are conflicted about what they want, often to the point where they have no clear idea what they're actually looking for. Take Anna Karenina, for example. Not only is it hard for the reader to pin down what's driving her, Anna herself can't articulate precisely what's lacking in her life. She wants her lover, Count Vronsky, but for much of the book, spoiler alert, she has him. And yet, having him does not satisfy her for all sorts of reasons. Her desperation grows as the costs of leaving her husband and losing her child mount up. There's something unreachable in Anna, something even she can't reach, that makes her supremely human, frustrating, and poignant. Miss Havisham, in Great Expectations, is unlucky in love, too, and, another spoiler alert, she also comes to a bad end. But while Miss Havisham's death is lurid and dramatically satisfying, it isn't as heartbreaking as the death of Anna Karenina. Miss Havisham's death is an ironic comeuppance of a flat character, but Anna's death is the last resort of a confused, desperate, passionate, and utterly lifelike human being. So, how do these distinctions between major and minor characters, or between round and flat characters, figure into the process of creating them? With the first distinction, it's pretty simple. Minor characters get less space and attention in a narrative than the major characters do. You don't need a great deal of description or a complicated backstory for a waiter who is simply providing your character with a cup of coffee. But even here, you might want to expend a bit more effort than just saying, the waiter brought her a cup of coffee. You might want to add an adjective or a clause or two in order to give that waiter a bit more substance than just a coffee delivery mechanism. Even if you say something as simple as, a sour old waiter brought her a cup of coffee, or a nervous young waiter brought her a cup of coffee, you're not only adding a little evocative texture to the scene, you're also suggesting that the world you're creating is so complex and rich that if you wanted to, you could follow that waiter home and find out why he's sour or nervous. Now, no matter whether a character is major or minor or flat or round, at some point you need to think self-consciously about his or her function in your narrative. In my last lecture, I talked about two different techniques for creating character. You can either construct a character in advance or let the character develop organically as you write the narrative. Either way, you're going to come at some point to a visceral understanding of how that character figures in the story. Not only is she major or minor, but what does she want, and how simple or complex is that desire? Sometimes this means that a character you thought was round is really flat, or vice versa. A character you thought was round and complex may actually turn out to do nothing more than move the plot along. In the opening chapters of Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, for example, we meet a character named Dr. Mortimer, who gets a lot of screen time, as it were, explaining the setup of the mystery to Sherlock Holmes. But in the end, Dr. Mortimer turns out to be pretty uninteresting and unimportant. Having served his purpose, there really isn't much more for him to do, and on a second reading of the novel, you may wonder, as I did, why Conan Doyle included him at all. On the other hand, you may discover that a character you meant to be a minor character turns out to be rounder and more important than you thought. Early in my novel Next, my main character Kevin, a middle-aged man who has come to Austin, Texas for a job interview, meets a middle-aged businesswoman in a coffee shop and is inadvertently rude to her. When I was writing this scene, in which she first appeared, this woman didn't even have a name or a backstory. She was just there for me to show that Kevin was the sort of callow middle-aged guy who would ignore an attractive woman his own age because he thinks he still has a shot with younger women. Then, without my intending her to show up again or even be referred to, she turned up, much to my own surprise, under very different circumstances at the end of the book. Suddenly she was round and complicated with a name, Melody, and an inner life and a fate all her own, independent of her encounter with Kevin earlier in the book. As a result of this happy accident, I went back and slightly reworked her first scene to make her a little more memorable, so that when she turned up again at the end, her return felt more organic and believable and not like some plot trick on my part. In other words, in the course of constructing the novel, I had to think self-consciously about what sort of character Melody was, just as I did with every other character, even those whose function or fate didn't change. In the next two lectures, I'll be talking about writing dialogue. The first lecture is about the mechanics of writing dialogue, and the second lecture is about using dialogue to evoke character and tell the story. It's also about integrating the dialogue into the rest of the narrative. In the meantime, here's an exercise to help you think about how different sorts of characters can function in a narrative. Take a story you like, or use a completed draft of one of your own stories. List all the characters, this won't work if you're George R. R. Martin, and leave a little space after each name. Then describe what each character wants as briefly as possible and using only what the story itself says about the character. I think you'll learn pretty quickly who is flat and who is round and who is major and who is minor. Sherlock Holmes's entry might say he wants to solve the crime and impress everyone with his brilliance. Anna Karenina's entry might say she wants the sort of passion from another man that she's never had from her husband, but in truth, she doesn't really know what she wants. These two are pretty obvious, but if you find yourself pausing over that waiter and wondering what else he wants to do besides deliver that cup of coffee, you may discover that you have some work to do. A final word about character. All writers, whether we have thought about it consciously or not, have a theory or at least a strong opinion about what human beings are like, whether people are fundamentally good, fundamentally self-interested, or fundamentally amoral. We express that theory or opinion through the depiction of the characters in our work. In other words, when we create fictional characters, we reveal what we think about real people, even if the characters are wholly imaginary. The greatest writers have a rich and expansive view of humanity. Shakespeare's menagerie of memorable characters encompasses every sort of person, from the most venal and conniving, such as Iago in Othello, to the comic and endearing, such as the nurse in Romeo and Juliet, to the most conflicted and complex, such as Hamlet. Other writers are not as warm or all-inclusive as Shakespeare. Dashiell Hammett had a much narrower view of human nature in The Maltese Falcon, where every character, from Sam Spade to the femme fatale Bridget O'Shaughnessy, is cynical and self-interested. But while Hammett's view of human nature may not be as nuanced or humane as Shakespeare's, it's still distinctively and recognizably his own. Whether we're creating characters with the power and complexity of Shakespeare's or with the focused, visceral force of Hammett's, every detail, quirk, and foible of a character is like a dab of paint in a pointless portrait of our personal view of human nature. And not just human nature in the abstract. As the great Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges put it, a man sets himself the task of portraying the world. Through the years, he peoples a space with images of provinces, kingdoms, mountains, bays, ships, islands, fishes, rooms, instruments, stars, horses, and people. Shortly before his death, he discovers that the patient labyrinth of lines traces the image of his face.
Lecture 7, The Mechanics of Writing Dialogue.
Just as people do in real life, people in fiction talk to each other. And like real people, fictional characters have all sorts of reasons for talking to each other. To convey information, to persuade, to dissuade, to inspire, to manipulate, to tell the truth, to lie, to seduce, to enrage, to comfort, to amuse. But as with everything else in fiction, it isn't enough just to reproduce the way that real people talk. In my first lecture about character, I talked about how fictional people are often more memorable than real people because they are less complicated and more vivid. By the same token, dialogue in fiction can be more vivid and memorable than real speech, and for many of the same reasons that characters are more vivid than real people. In real life, speech and conversation can be rambling, ungrammatical, incoherent, ambiguous, repetitive, inconclusive, and dull. Fiction writers often mimic these effects to make characters sound more lifelike, but in the end, fictional speech can only suggest real speech, not reproduce it. If you've ever read a transcript of a real conversation, you'll have noticed that it didn't read anything like the speech we see in fiction. If you compare the speech of the real conspirators in the Watergate tapes, for example, with the conspirators in a Shakespeare history play like Julius Caesar,